Today on Rambling About Cars, we have an entire episode dedicated to cool, interesting, obscure cars through the decades. And if you think you're an expert on this, you are still going to learn something because our special guest this week has a garage and ownership history that will blow your mind. So without further ado, it is podcast time. I'm excited about this. I'm Christopher Smith, and across the way is co-host Mr. Chris Bruce.
That's right. This is kind of my dream show, I have to say. This is someone who I've been following on social media for years. This is someone who, because of where my parents live, I've kind of known about for a while, and I'm so happy to finally to get to talk to him. Myron Vernis is our guest today.
Yes.
And he is, we were kind of, Smith, you and I were saying this before the show, if you and I had a little bit more disposable income, we would have the car collection he has, because there's just a smattering of everything from obscure Japanese stuff to interesting European stuff to American stuff with an interesting history behind it. Myron, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us tonight, and we're so happy to have you. So welcome to the show.
Hey, honored to be asked, and thank you for having me on board. I got to say, I'm a little bit nervous about living up to that type of introduction. I mean, as you guys were mentioning those things, I was thinking, who was the guest really supposed to be today?
No,
it's you. Trust me.
I mean, I consider myself pretty knowledgeable on interesting kind of unknown cars. For example, you have a 1982 Ford Durango, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
1980. Bruce and I did a podcast. It was a few weeks ago where we do a cheap car challenge. And the challenge,
like 8 weeks ago.
Was it 8 weeks? No. Oh, my gosh. Time is going too fast.
Anyways,
what you have that car on your website listed in your normal category. And right. I picked a Ford Durango as my obscure car to try to find a car that Bruce didn't know about. So, yeah, your collection is amazing. Before we jump into the collection, I want to let all the listeners know, you want to go and follow us on our YouTube channel, Motor One Podcast. You want to like, subscribe, follow, hit every single mash button you can. Follow us on all the socials. Follow us over on our audio platform, Spotify, Google, Apple, all of the good stuff. The more you do, the more it helps us get listeners, the more it helps the algorithm, so more people can hear about collections like Myron has. So thank you, sir, for joining us. If we could, how many cars do you own right now?
You know, it's a good question, but, you know, my daughter, I have a daughter, it's an attorney, she's much better at knowing these things than I do, but I'd say the ballpark is 75.
Whoa.
Yeah, right around 75 or so.
75 cars. Okay. Now, I thought I was kind of, you know, smarty hardy for owning 34 cars in the last 20 years. You have 75 right now. I mean, that's, where do you even start? Okay. Let me ask this. Of your 75 cars, I won't ask for a favor, because that's just going to be impossible. What can you, can you give us like a top five? What are your top five in that collection?
Yeah, you know, it's almost impossible, and especially this time of year when we have like 2 feet of snow out on the ground and you're just kind of forced to look at everything. But I'd say there's really – that changes on a day-to-day basis. Like if you ask me, you know, what's on my list to buy or what's my favorite car? I know you guys like to do cars of the decades and stuff. You know, that would change on a day-to-day basis. So I really can't say. Like today, I was getting some cars ready to be shipped out. My Paxton Phoenix – got to drive it in the snow and the rain today because it's going to the Peterson Museum for an extended display. And got the 48 Davis, you know, the big three-wheeler, and the 66 Hino Contessa. So they were all kind of running and driving today. So it was, you know, you kind of get that back, and it's pretty exciting. But I really can't say that I have a top five. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be evasive about that. Yeah, that shot of the Hino was when I was, it's in California, and I was taking it to the Japanese Classic Car Show, and I blew a push rod on the 405 and it got off at the nearest exit. And what you don't see is a little puddle of oil back behind it, but had a nice bowl of oatmeal waiting for the tow truck at Denny's. So.
Now, if you're following us on YouTube, we do have some images up on YouTube that you can follow along with. Could you explain just for the listeners, and I'm sure there's a few out there that aren't familiar, what exactly is a Hino Contessa?
Yeah, well, most people are aware of Hino being Toyota's medium-duty truck line now. But Hino was an automotive manufacturer, went back to the 30s. They started out, they started doing other things besides cars. But they started in the car business as being the Japanese concessionaire. Yeah, that's me cleaning it up. So the Japanese concessionaire for Renault. So they assembled Renaults in Japan for decades. And then in the early 60s, they decided to start building cars their own design. They hired Michelotti to design the bodies of the cars. They did a rear engine layout similar to the Renaults that they've been used to buying. And that's it. Well, Toyota bought Hino in the mid 60s. And at that point, they stopped building cars so they wouldn't be competition for themselves. Little known fact is, everybody knows Pete Brock and the BRE race team, you know, and the Datsuns that they raced. Well, the BRE race team was built around Hinos, and they had to scramble and find Datsun after Toyota bought Hino and stopped automotive production. So the first BRE race cars and the first cars that Pete Brock won races with BRE were Hino Contessas.
And it's worth pointing out that the engine is in the back, which you don't necessarily, you look at that vehicle and you don't necessarily know that. And I'm trying to pull it up because you posted it on your Instagram, a very good shot of a vintage Contessa in BRE livery racing. But yeah, the engine is in the rear, even though you kind of look at it and it seems like the engine should be in the front.
Yeah, it's an inline four rear mounted liquid cooled.
Yeah,
I'm learning that right now. I just learned about Hino like last week when I was, when I was really starting to do a deep dive into this. And this car is going to be on display down at Amelia Island. Is that correct? Coming up?
Yes. This year, for the first time at really any major Concours event, there's going to be a class of Japanese production sports cars. And
that's fantastic.
Going to be some really interesting. Yeah, really interesting stuff. I mean, we have a 2000 GT coming, a Z432, of course, a Skyline GTR, but even more obscure things like the Hino. There's an Isuzu Bullet GTR coming, Toyota Sports 800. So it'll be some things that most people who know Japanese cars have never seen.
You own a Bullet, don't you? Or you did at one point?
Oh, yeah. I've got a Bullet GTR and a Sports 800.
That's an impressive collection.
The Sports 800 is just, I just need to stop there for a second because I'm just a huge fan of that car. As well as like some of the other Hondas of that era, just these small cars,
Toyota
that,
bud,
that just yeah. love, that just love to rev and just love to have fun. They just so get overlooked. So it's so nice to hear an event as prestigious as Amelia Island. We're finally getting a look into really a section of automotive history that's kind of unknown in the United States, and it's unfortunate.
But an S800, which is the Honda. The Sports 800 is the Toyota. Okay.
Toyota's first sports car. There will be at Amelia. Peter Cunningham is bringing his S600 coupe, which is super special car, left-hand drive S600 coupe. So they'll be represented also.
So, Myron, I don't know how many opportunities I'm going to get to have to talk to you. So I have two questions for you because of my family. And so I have to ask. So my mother's dream car is a Chevy Corvair. It has always been since she was a young teenage girl. And in our correspondence with you, you said that you owned Raymond Loewy's, who is a famous industrial designer. I was reading up about him today. He worked at Studebaker, which was where I was familiar with him. But I only learned today he designed the livery of Air Force One, that dark blue, light blue, white livery. That's Raymond Loewy's design, which I did not know until today. And you owned his Corvair. So my mother is going to love you for that. And then also, my father's dream car is a Porsche 914, and you happen to own a Porsche 914 pickup truck, which I'm going to throw up here in a second. So just, I don't know when I'm going to get to talk to you again. So could you please talk about those two vehicles?
Sure. I've always been a big, I have no artistic talent whatsoever. So I've always kind of gravitated towards artists and designers and stylists, and with car design, especially industrial designers like Raymond Loewy, like Brooke Stevens, who really never worked for any automotive companies, but they did contract work. And sure. Loewy did amazing work for Studebaker. And he always is a very stylish guy. There's a great 60 Minutes interview with him from about 1970 or so that if you ever have 20 minutes to waste on YouTube, it's really good. And he was kind of famous for taking really, really cool cars and kind of personalizing them. And he wasn't always successful from everybody else's eyes. But like he had BMW 507, E-Type Jaguar, things like that, that he really kind of changed up a lot. Well, he also designed the Studebaker Avanti, which is probably the thing that he's most famous for at this point.
Yeah.
He lived in Palm Springs. But he also had a townhouse on Park Avenue where he needed a town car. So in 64, he bought a new Corvair sedan and immediately sent it to the people that did all his modification work in France, a firm called Pichon Perrot, small coach building firm. And they modified it for him. And they raised the rear roof and they lowered the rear floor. They reupholstered it. He designed a special mid-century carpet that was woven, that was put in there. Put a fake grill on it, did some cane work painting on it. And there's a little light on top that was always lit when he was driven around in it. So there was no ego going on there. But no shortage of ego.
Sure.
So there was, he kept it till about 1970 when it was involved in an accident. Wasn't thrilled with the way the insurance company was dealing with them. So he sold it to his building superintendent for $250. And I ended up buying it from the son of the building superintendent. And interesting how I kind of came about it. It was on Craigslist in Asbury Park, New Jersey.
No way.
And I was on vacation in
Craigslist.
Yeah. I mean, for like $5,000. Okay.
No
It needed work. Yeah. It needed work. It sat in a carport for, 15 years. But a friend, another automotive journalist friend, sent me an email saying, you really need to buy this car. And we were in Greece, so the time difference, I finally got a hold of the seller. I asked him for proof that it was Raymond Loewy's car, and he sent me pictures of registrations, insurance cards, everything. So no question there. And my next question is, well, at $5,000, how come no one's bought it yet? And his answer was, the Corvair people just keep calling me and telling me how ugly it is. And, the Corvair's a very clean design, and it might be uglier than a regular Corvair, but it was a personal artifact, the greatest industrial designer to ever live. So
yeah,
we ended up buying it, and it's about 90% restored at this point.
That's a great story. And to me, that's the magic of being a car enthusiast. It's not just the car. Every older car, used car, has a story behind it, and oftentimes the story can be more interesting than the car. And I'm not saying that Corvair isn't interesting, because I love them too, to have that kind of story, that's gold. Do all of your cars have stories like that? I'm assuming no, but let me ask a quick question here before we get over to Porsche's to Bruce's 914, which I'm glad you brought that up, because I love that thing too. What's the coolest car story you have in your collection?
Well, I kind of buy cars for stories lots of times. I mean, I buy really crappy cars sometimes because the story is so great. So, I'd like to think just about all my cars have stories. So I can't say one is better than the other.
Okay.
Like the 914 pickup, the story there is, I was really heavily into Porsche 356s for the longest time when they were cheap. When I was buying them, you could buy a running driving car for less than $1,000. In fact, I still have.
I wish that was still true today.
Yeah, right. I still have my, but you know, you can still buy cool cars for cheap. You just kind of have to, you know, set your target a little differently.
Yep. I know. Yep.
And they were cheap when I was buying them in the 70s because nobody wanted them. And, I still have my first one that I paid 46 years ago. I paid $1,500 for it because it had a rebuilt engine and a new paint job. And that was the only reason you'd pay so much money for it. But being into Porsches, you know, one of the, well, the Mecca for old Porsches was in Southern California. And in Southern California, in Anaheim, was a place called Ossie Brothers Wrecking. And it was a wrecking yard, just Porsche only. And over the years, got to be friendly with, the Ossie brothers, but Dave Ossie primarily. And the story on that car, I first saw that car in his shop. There was a coach building firm called Troutman Barnes that they built Cheetah race cars, Chaparral race cars. They did other things. Master auto work, bodybuilders. Dave, in the early 70s, the Ossie brothers in the early 70s ran an ad for Rep 914-6 in the LA Times for like $3,500. Dick Troutman from Troutman Barnes comes in to buy the car, who built into a pickup to use for a shop truck for his business, for his coach building business. Uh-huh. And Dave Ossie says to him, "That sounds like a pretty cool idea. If I give you another one, can you build one for me too?" So yeah, that's it. So Dave gave him that car, and Troutman Barnes built two at the same time. One was Troutman's, that was 914-6, and the one he built for Ossie Brothers is a four-cylinder, which is the one I got. And it went on to, the Ossie Brothers sold it to one of their very, very big clients, who was a friend of mine, who passed it on to one of his best friends, who was also a mutual friend of mine, and I got it from them. In fact, they have probably the premier Porsche sales and restoration facility in the country right now, a place called Road Scholars down in North Carolina.
So let me
just, where it came from. So
let me just get this straight here. There are two of these Porsche 914 pickup trucks in existence. Yes. And
yeah, correct.
And you bought one for $3,500.
No. The 914-6. Troutman bought the one for $3,500 he built into the six-cylinder. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. And still that car is with, the six-cylinder still exists too. It's with Kevin Jeanette, Gunner Racing down in Florida.
Oh, okay. I'm familiar with them.
And, I think that's just a very, I'm not a 914 fan. I got to be honest, but
you're wrong, Smith. You're wrong.
I am wrong like 25% of the time.
You're wrong.
And by that I mean probably 90%. But the truck conversion, that's the thing. I'm not a truck guy either. I don't really like trucks. I don't really like the 914. I love this, and maybe it's just because it's different and interesting, and my own ownership history over the years has kind of gravitated towards the different and the interesting. And
Smith, look at the picture we have on now and tell me that's not cool.
So for those not on YouTube, and you really should for this one, or you can also follow Myron on his socials that we'll get to here in a little bit. One of two Porsche 914 pickup trucks in the world. And here's a picture of it doing truck stuff. There's a set of tires in the back. I love it. It doesn't just sit in a garage. I mean, it's sitting here in grass and dirt. I mean, it looks fantastic. I mean, it's not like it's, you know, out in the desert. But I mean, you're doing truck stuff with it. Do you drive all of your vehicles, or are there some that are just like, okay,
everything that's drivable, gets driven. And up until this year, I really didn't drive anything. You know, less than 30 plus years old. I inherited an old Subaru from my daughter, so I'm driving that this winter, thankfully, because of all the snow we've gotten. But, cars are great to drive.
Subaru, I need to know, as a Subaru owner, what type of Subaru are you driving?
An Outback that she inherited from us when she graduated from college. So,
My first Subaru story is a 1990 Legacy L wagon that this was back when I was getting cars every 6 to 8 months. I went through a period that I call a used car addiction phase that I could still be in today if I ever decide to sell this this 95 Mustang that I've got. But I picked up that 90 Subaru Legacy L. It was all-wheel drive in Michigan, extremely rusty for, I think I paid $400 for it. And the left rear strut, actually the strut tower rusted away, and the strut was wedged into the seat back. I got that welded up by a guy in Ann Arbor. And then a couple years later, because I was always a fan of that first gen Legacy, I found a 91 Legacy SS, which was the turbo. And I broke my used car rule book. I fell in love with it before I ever saw it in person. And the photos, it looked okay, but it was rusty, and it was described as rusty. And the guy was selling it for $1,000. He was in Sault Ste. Marie. And he drove down to Gaylord, Michigan, which is about probably a three-hour drive for him, and I drove 3 hours north, and met him in the middle of winter, and it's leaking fuel, which, okay, that's no-no number two. One, don't fall in love with the car before you buy it. And this applies really to cheap cars. Don't fall in love with the car before you buy it. Two, if there's a fuel leak anywhere, just walk away. You should really walk away, especially when it's as rusty as it. But no, I went ahead and I gave him $1,000 for it, I think. And I spent the next 2 months just crying because it was really too rusty to take apart underneath. I mean, it was a case of everything's just going to fall apart if you try to take it apart. So I managed to patch up the fuel leak a little bit, got it sold, and I've never had another Legacy since then. But the Outback, you mentioned Outback. I've been very close on getting Outbacks many, many times. What year Outback is that one?
I'm an 11 right now, but my wife's obsessed with Outback. She's on her fourth one. Oh, so wow. We just, good. Every few years they, you know, she gets a new one or it goes on. You know, you got to have one reliable car in the house. So that's
right. So I've got a 2012 Outback. So no shame. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you, I think that first generation of the new model Outback was really the pivotal car for Subaru. I think that's kind of what made, yep, Subaru, you know, the car that it is today, the car that everybody wants to buy. You know, to me, they're, agreed, they're kind of soulless and kind of numb to drive, but they are absolute magic in the bad weather and the snow. And they're totally genius marketing people, right? They don't talk about their cars in the ads. They talk about dogs and kids, and they sell as many as they can make.
They do, yeah. Yeah, we get the Subaru magazine that they send out, and I think it's something like 70% of Outback owners own a dog. It's something crazy, yeah, like that. That, like, they know that that's their market. So no problem,
yeah,
there.
No, they're geniuses at marketing. You know, Mazda, on the other hand, who makes fantastic automobiles, you know, couldn't sell themselves out of a wet paper bag for some reason.
These days, that's true. Yeah.
I was in love with my 2004 Mazda 6 until about a year ago when it's just started leaking from every possible spot. I shouldn't complain. I've had the car. I bought the car used in 2012. It's the 6S hatchback, the 5-door hatch, which is a pretty rare car to find. And I mean, it doesn't get driven very much, and it was rock solid. I mean, I had to do new front calipers at like 60,000 miles. There's just something weird. They were locking up, but it was flawless until like 107,000 miles. And then the water pump started to leak. Well, okay, it's 107,000. So we replaced it with another water pump, and the shop was using just kind of cheapy water pumps. I went through two water pumps under warranty. And then by the time they got that figured out, other spots are leaking, other coolant leaks, other oil leaks. So I'm not a Mazda fan at the moment, but it'll pass.
I'm kind of passively a Mazda fan. I'm trying to think how many I have right now. I have the predecessor to your car. I have a 626, like an 82 626.
Okay. Yep.
Mm-hmm. That was built as a rally car for the Peking to Paris rally in 82, which for some reason didn't happen. I think political reasons. So it's got like 300 some miles on it. I think its biggest claim to fame is our kids learned to drive a stick shift in it.
Okay.
And then I think a Nissan Sentra, Nissan something that's Playboy sponsored, right? Am I mistaken there?
There was an endurance race series back in the early to mid 80s that was sponsored by Playboy. It was ironically for a year or two, it was sponsored by Escort radar detectors and Playboy. So Playboy and Escort both on the same car. So,
yeah. So super, a quick question for you, and a car that of yours that I'm interested in is here. I'm going to try to pull up a picture of it while I'm talking, and I'm failing at doing that. So you put up a story. You found a bizarre DKW in Stowe, Ohio, which for anyone who doesn't know, Stowe is, it's kind of a suburb of a suburb of Akron. It's a weird area. It's a suburb of Kent. Like it, I can't kind of define where it is, but you found this DKW Monza somewhere in Stowe. And can you kind of tell that story? Cause A, I'm curious where you found it. And B, I'm just curious about the story. So can you kind of tell that?
Can you hear me?
Yep. There we
hear you now. Yep, we lost you for a second.
Okay, great. So yeah, one of about 100 DKW Monzas made. And, you know, they were never sent to this country. So it was my ex-brother-in-law, who wasn't an ex at the time, who always kind of fancied himself to be a car guy. And okay. He happened to see this, and this is a house that I driven past like 100 times. It was actually on the border of Stowe and Monroe Falls, if you know the area. So like two,
I do know that area.
White bread bedroom communities, right? You really don't expect anything. And I've driven past that house
exactly
forever. And for one reason, my brother-in-law drove past it and the car was uncovered. It was under a blue tarp, you know, the famous Kmart blue tarp. And he said, he's about a week later, he sees me and says, yeah, I saw this fiberglass bodied Mercedes sports car. And I thought, okay. You know, really nice. Fiberglass body. But, you know, it had some rings and stuff. And, you know, for a while, Mercedes did own, you know, the brand. So that he did what he told me what he was told. And he gave me the address. I went back to the address. And sure enough, there was that tarp. And, you know, again, having driven past that place 100 times, I assumed it was like a pile of mulch that had been tarped over, because that's what we do here in Northeast Ohio. You get the big pile of mulch in the spring and cover it till you can spread it. And it was round and stuff. And I knocked on the guy's door. It took me two or three trips till the guy answered, and he pulled it over and he told me about the Mercedes sports car. And, you know, obviously you don't argue with the guy that you want to try.
Of course not.
And I had a flatbed on hold, and really kind of bought it within 30 minutes and had it hauled out of there. So it had spent a lot of time just south of Akron in the Canton area, back to about the mid 60s. But I never was able to trace the history back and how it got to the United States before that.
Huh. I mean, if you don't mind mentioning, can you tell me what you paid for that? Because I'm just curious. If you don't want to say, that's fine, but I'm very curious.
I'm kind of a bottom feeder. I don't pay. I mean, there are a few cars I paid out for, but I want to say it was like $1,000.
Jesus.
Nice. Nice.
But, you know, as sad as it looks in that picture, it was probably in worse shape. You know how photos of cars always make them look better than they are. So.
Of course.
The above RE, that legacy SS that I bought, that it's just a little rusty on the fenders. I just couldn't take anything apart underneath.
Yeah. Well, you notice I didn't even bother to take the trash can out when I took that.
Sure. It must not have been that special. Yeah. Oh man. That's
Smith, I feel like I've been asking lots of questions. You have one. I like this has been
one. What? Well, I'm gonna jump over to your website. You have a website, mobiliagarage.com. We'll put links in the YouTube description. Links in our article that'll go up on Friday at motorone.com, so people can see it. Just a little bit about you and a little bit of the cars and some of the other things you have. But yeah. I've been a wagon guy for quite a while. My first wagon was that Subaru Legacy L, a 1990, I had. I've had a couple Taurus wagons. Well, I just had one Taurus wagon over the years. The one that got away that I wish I could get back, I'll unfortunately never be able to get back, was a 1987 Mercury Sable LS station wagon that had a fantastic story behind it, because it had been modified by a Ford engineer in the early 90s with the Taurus Show V6 5-speed manual. And it had some other work. And it was a fantastic car that sadly I sold it to a guy in California, and it got caught in one of the wildfires last year and burned up.
That's too bad.
But thinking about all of that, you have a Citroen CX wagon.
Mm-hmm.
I would
Before we talk about this, let me tell you my Taurus wagon story a little bit. We were living in Peoria, Illinois in the mid to late 80s. And whatever car my wife was driving, it needed our Toyota had turned a bunch of miles. So we ordered a new Fox wagon. Remember the two-door VW Fox wagons?
Yes.
That were out?
Yeah.
Really cool cars. So we put a deposit on one of those, and the dealer strung us along forever. The car never got delivered. In the meantime, we find out that my wife's pregnant with our first child. So we took the deposit back, and the local Ford dealer was a friend. And his dealer demo, this is in 1987, was a Taurus wagon, an MT5. So the 5-speed transmission and the Taurus.
That's so funny. Yeah. Smith was just talking about MT5s a few weeks ago.
You had an MT5 wagon? That is like beyond rare. I'm in awe.
Yeah.
You're the only other person I've talked to outside of my Taurus club people, and we're all weirdos, that have ever even known that they made an MT5 wagon with the 5-speed manual.
Yeah, and they only offered the 5-speed with the 4-cylinder. You couldn't get the V6 with the 5-speed. But he was a Bonneville racer, and he raced the Chisitalia Formula Junior, so he was kind of a petrol head, unlike most car dealers. So he found a special high compression head option. So not only was it a 5-speed wagon, but it had a special head on it. So it had like 6,000 miles. I bought it from him. And within a month, the head failed on it, and the paint lifted, the clear coat on the paint lifted. So we replaced it with a standard head, and the head had the top end of the car repainted. And that thing was an absolute gem of a car for us. It went 180 some thousand miles, never had to replace the clutch. The brakes were like brand new, but it finally gave it up when it was rusted out. And I think my wife saw it in a grocery store like a couple of years later, still kind of hanging on. But
I've never seen an MT5 wagon in person. I know they exist, and I've been a Taurus guy for a while. I've had I've owned a dozen of the first and second generation shows over the years. I kind of got sucked into those. And then, I had a regular, just an 87 Taurus GL wagon for a little while. That was another one of my, I think I paid like $500 or $600 for it. I mean, it was the Vulcan V6, the 3-liter that was just bulletproof. Kind of like the 2.5, just would go forever. I got that Sable wagon that had such a great story behind it. Really, I've told people over the years, if Ford actually did follow through and build a show wagon, that Sable would have been it, because I had a stack of paperwork with that car, probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 inches thick, where this engineer, he lived in Dearborn, and he did the conversion, I think in like 91, 90 or 91. and he bought every single official Ford part that he needed through dealerships. He had CAD or not CAD, but like blueprints of some of the early upgrades that they were doing with the shifters. I mean, just the story was fantastic. And I'm just in awe that you had, not only have you seen what you've owned, I should have known you've owned an MT5 wagon. I'm going to be quiet now on Fords because I could do 2 hours on this just alone. But I would love to hear about the Citroen, because that car, I think those cars are just amazing.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool car. And we kind of ended up with some station wagons just because, you know, they are cool. The Toyota you just had up, that's like that 914 pickup. It's one of those cars that everybody loves. Just, you know, they're not, you know, that Toyota wagon, the 73 front. Yeah, but you know, it's got dings and dents, but it just has like this magnetic appeal for people. The Citroen, again, kind of a Porsche connection with that, was a friend of mine who was a Porsche dealer, a very early Porsche dealer in Cleveland, Chuck Stoddard from Stoddard Imports. Brought Stoddard that over.
Yeah,
Stoddard still sells. He was the real pioneer in Porsche 356 and restoration parts.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
He was on vacation in, I probably shouldn't even say this, but he was on vacation in Switzerland, saw this in a showroom in Zurich and in 85, and had a friend of his bring it over on a vacation visa in 1985 and conveniently forget it in Cleveland. And about 10 years or so ago, Chuck called me and said, hey, I've really only sold like two or three of my own personal cars ever. But everyone says, I need to sell this car to you. So we bought it, and it was a perfect car. And Chuck was, in addition to being a Porsche racer, ex-SCCA national champ, he was also an MIT graduate engineer. So his stuff is like absolutely perfect. Had like 50,000 wow. original kilometers on it. One small glitch was it never had a U.S. title, so we had to get a little creative with that. But now it's totally a legal car, and it's just it's a sweet car. It's made a lot of trips up to the Detroit area, kind of moving stuff for my daughter.
I love that. I mean, ordinarily I would expect a car like that to not be making trips moving things, you know. I love that the vehicles in your collection are still vehicles. They're special. You care for them, you show them, you appreciate them, but they are still vehicles. They are still doing their first best duty of transporting people and goods and things. I would flip out if I saw that wagon on the street anywhere. I would pull over. I might chase you down. The police might be called because I might get a little aggressive. I'm a nut for wagons, and especially things like this. And your story, the story behind it. Bruce, this could easily go. We need to do sequels, I think, on this one.
Myron, I hope you want to talk to us again. I hope we're not like being too nerdy with you, that you don't feel like that scene from Wayne's World where it's just we're not worthy, because I feel like that's what it is. Like, I feel like you're Alice Cooper and Smith and I are Wayne and Garth, and it's just we're not worthy, because like, you're everything we want to be in terms of car enthusiasts. Everything, whether it's American, whether it's European, whether it's Japanese, whether it's whatever, you're what we want to be. And this is fantastic. And I love it. And I'm being nerdy right now in a way I haven't been on this show, I don't think ever. But I love it, man.
Well, let me bring it back here a little bit.
I hope this doesn't kill your audience kind of doing this stuff.
I don't care.
No, our audience is just as interesting as you are, as we are. I mean, the show is called Rambling About Cars because we ramble about cars. Right. I would like to ask you.
Real quick, Smith, our show's name actually takes inspiration from Rambler. We were kind of trying to come up with an automotive-inspired name, and we thought we had a lot of ideas coming into this, and we ended up with Rambling, and the name of the show comes from Rambler. So, you know, and I know, obviously, with the Raymond Loewy connection, that Rambler is in there. So, yeah.
If I could, now, let me ask you about your Robin. Now, this isn't a Reliant Robin, and I've never actually heard of this. Is it Meba? Is that how you pronounce it? Amoeba? Meba Robin?
Mavel.
So okay. I've mispronounced something. Yeah, I always mispronounce something in an episode, so I've made that achievement. I mean, tell us about just how you got this car.
It's a Greek word, so that, you know, it's a Greek pronunciation. You know, it's basically a left-hand drive Reliant Robin that was built under license in Greece for about 3 years. The bodies were actually made in Greece, but the chassis, the running gear, the engine are stock Reliant Robin. And it was just one of those where, that was when we brought it home.
we're showing an image here from Twitter.
I'm Greek and I love cars, and I figured I needed to have a Greek car. So that's kind of how we ended up with it. A Greek collector friend of mine had one. It's beautiful, and just beautifully cosmetically, just beautiful cosmetically. That picture that you just put up was when I bought it from him in Athens, and we were taking it. We have a place on the island of Crete, and my daughter was in, she was doing a clerkship with a law firm outside of Athens, and we kind of made it a father-daughter trip where we picked it up in Athens, took the ferry overnight, and took about the 50-kilometer ride to our home, and turns out that the radiator was stuck. So we were 5 or 6 stops later, and it was Greek election day, which means everything is closed. So every time we ran out of water, we had to pull into like a Greek restaurant that was closed. Fortunately, they never locked their doors. So we would just walk into the kitchens, get pitchers of water, fill them up, and move on another time.
That's
wonderful. Let me ask you about the driving experience, because I'm very curious. I've obviously never, I've seen one in person once. I was at the Cruz auction in Indiana several years ago, and I saw one there. And I'm willing to bet most of our listeners have never driven one, but we know a very popular automotive motoring show based in the UK kind of portrayed these Robin three-wheelers as a little unsafe. Are they really, really that tippy to drive?
Yeah, I wouldn't say terrifying, but it's not good. Yeah, it's not good at all. And the ironic thing is we have another big three-wheel car here in the States called the Davis, which was built in the late 40s. And it is light years from a handling and ride standpoint, stability standpoint, light years ahead of the Robin, which was built 30 years after it. And the crazy thing about the Davis, there were 16 of them built, 15 still exist, and the only one that isn't around was bought by Reliant to study, and then they crushed it rather than pay duty or to ship it back to the States. So, you know, they had stuff to work with, but listen, everyone's seen the Clarkson bit on Top Gear with him flipping the Robin, but that's a little extreme. But anybody I've taken for a ride in it is everyone who's gone for a ride in ours has said they're one and done.
Okay, interesting. Well, from something one and done, to something that I think would be over and over and over and over again. Bruce, you're probably going to agree with me on this. Can you talk about your Mazda Cosmo?
Smith, real quick. Coincidences are perfect. I was going to show something else, which is that Myron happens to have a dog named Cosmo, and you know we love dogs on this show.
We do.
So I just want to show, here is Cosmo in a Suzuki X90. Cosmo is a gorgeous sheephound. Is he a sheephound or is he a collie?
Well, he's not mine. He's my daughter's. And he's a Saint Berdoodle. He's a Saint Berdoodle.
Oh. So. Okay. Well.
Standard poodle.
So.
Yeah.
He is a gorgeous pup, and we love pups on this show. But okay, Smith, now go ahead. Let's switch over to your Cosmo, which also has the same name.
Yes, I mean, just.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You don't see many of them on the street. I would love to hear this story.
Yeah, the Cosmo is just one of those special cars that if you ever have the opportunity to get to drive one, it really is unbelievable. It's unlike any other rotary engine car ever built. A friend of mine who's an automotive journalist who spent some time with me in the car really kind of describes it as a balanced Lotus Elan with the rotary engine. It really is. And you wouldn't think, right? It's got a solid rear axle. It's got leaf springs in the rear, but it's just one of those magic cars that I really can't explain what's so great about driving it, because it's just visceral, and they're cool. They're cool looking.
Oh yeah. Oh, it looks fantastic. Is there a car over the years, and even if it's not one, has there been a car or a car related experience over the years that's really surprised you? Like, maybe it's a car that you didn't expect to ever find, or something that was much better, or God forbid, something that was much worse. Just, you know, one of those really surprising moments over all of your experiences here.
Yeah, you know, that it's been kind of, I think everything has a positive aspect to it, even the cars that aren't such great cars. Like with the Cosmo, it was a driving experience. I bought it because it was cool, and I loved it. But you know, the positive side was how great a car it is to drive. But you know, even in like mundane cars, last year I bought a Hyundai Stellar XL. Stellar Executive. It was the high-end Stellar car. It was before Hyundai had gone totally over to their own cars. It was a Jajaro design body for Hyundai, but it was on a Cortina chassis and a Mitsubishi 4G32 engine. So it was just kind of cobbled together. They were just kind of feeling their way. And I feel like we're just at the precipice right now where Korean cars are going to become desirable and collectible, and they're becoming a force in the American car market right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's time that we start recognizing their history. And we found this car. It was on Cars and Bids. It was in Canada. And, you know, it's kind of an uninspiring car. It's a great example. It's got 90-some thousand original kilometers in excellent shape. But it's kind of an uninspiring car to drive. But the person I bought it from, we've become very good friends, and he's a great enthusiast. So, you know, that's the benefit of that. So it's there's a positive surprise in just about any car, whether it's the car itself or something, you know, it's tangential.
I know exactly what you mean. It was probably about 15 years ago. I was living in Whitmore Lake, just north of Ann Arbor. I was commuting back and forth to Dearborn. I was working with Ford Racing at the time. Gas prices were starting to go up. And I had a Taurus show at that point, an earlier one. But I decided, you know what? I want a three-cylinder Metro. I want to get this one of these little tiny three-cylinder Metros that gets about 50 miles to the gallon. I'll probably hate it, but it'll pay for itself. With all the driving, the commuting I was doing, it'll pay for itself in like a month. And I managed to find a 2000 Chevy Metro two-door, the two-door hatchback with a three-cylinder, five-speed manual. It's actually a tough car to find. And it had 150,000 miles, I think, on it. and it was running and driving okay. But I absolutely fell in love with that car. It was, its top speed was maybe 80, 85 miles an hour if I had a pretty good tailwind. But it was a thing where I would get on I-94 and I would just put it to the floor and keep it there. And I'm running with traffic on I-94 and I was still getting, I mean, even just flooring it all the time, I was still getting about 45 miles to the gallon. It had some exhaust work done to it. I'll go ahead and say this on the air. There was a shop in Dearborn. There was an exhaust leak coming from the catalytic converter. And I was ready to, hey, we'll repair it. We'll repair it, you know, properly. I went into the shop, you know, how much to, you know, replace the catalytic converter? He goes, oh, I just put in pipe for $50. Well, okay. If you want to do that, I guess that's fine. So it had like this little just angry three-cylinder rasp to it. It felt like a little go-kart that I could just put in my back pocket whenever I wanted. It was like the quintessential car that car people make fun of. And if I ever find another 2000 Metro three-door, five-speed, three-cylinder, I'm getting it.
Yeah, why not?
Send your ads, folks, to podcast@motorone.com if you have a three-cylinder 2000 Chevy Metro, five-speed, three-door. Christopher Smith just might want to buy it from you.
So, Myron, we're running out of time. We're on the tail end of this episode, and I'm curious about something. And that is, as Smith and I have discussed with you, you kind of have everything that we wish that we had. And I'm wondering, what is the next item on the wish list for you? What is the car that's kind of not necessarily your white whale, but what's the thing that you have your eye on? And if you don't necessarily want to say, hey, I'm shopping for this, but just in general, what are you keeping an eye on that I want to add to my collection in the future?
You know, I've never really targeted a whole heck of a lot of automobiles. I never had posters on my wall growing up. You know, I got into 356s because they were cool and I saw one on the street. I grew up in Akron and it was basically hot rodders and, you know, basically big American muscle cars when I was growing up. And I saw 356 and it kind of opened to a whole new world. I guess what I'd be interested in at this point is more Korean, interesting Korean cars. Again, first of all, from the historic aspect of it, that again, they become so important in the country at this point. Plus, there's still really, really good values on those things. You know, buying cheap cars, that thrill never goes away. And I think there's some really good values there, so you can get in, you know, on the ground level. There are some interesting things. There weren't a lot of good cars, but they were interesting cars. And it's interesting to kind of see their thought process and going through things. So that would be like maybe a focus. And then, you know, whatever comes. We, again, really not looking for anything at this point. Really should be getting rid of some stuff. You know, at my age, stuff.
Nope. Keep it all. Keep it all. Yeah. Keep adding. Keep going.
I'm curious, though, what part of Akron did you grow up in? Because I definitely heard some like kind of vague stories from my dad, my uncles, my dad's friends of like kind of street racing in that area. So I'm just curious, what part of that area did you grow up in?
I grew up on North Hill, which. We were the token Greeks in the Italian neighborhood.
Okay. But,
So did your whole automotive odyssey start with the 356? Would you say?
Yeah, I still have my first one, and there was a period. I know I've owned over 100 356s, over the years. Wow. But again, most of them bought for hundreds or low four figures. you know, that's kind of where the market was at the time. So
that's what I did. Yep, that's what I did over the years. I would buy something generally for a while. I was on a roll. I could get stuff for $400. Like, you know, I had an old Ford Escort GT, $400, Mark II GTI, $400. Granted, the GTI didn't have a floor, But I understand where you're at there. The thrill of the find can be sometimes greater than the ownership experience. And I think that's why, I mean, for a period, yeah. I mean, I was buying, fixing up, enjoying for about 6 or 8 months, selling, moving on to something else. The difference with us is you didn't really sell. I needed to sell to maintain the addiction.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's listen, you know, the beauty of buying cheap cars is that you can only go up from there, right? You buy a cheap car, anything if the radio works and if the heater heats, man, you're already on top of the ballgame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And each one has a story, and if it doesn't have an interesting story, the cheap cars, each one will have its own interesting personality. Things that other people would just kind of shake their head and be like, wow, I hate that. Like the 91 Dodge, or no, it was a 93 Dodge Spirit I had, where I could lock all of the doors, all four doors, but I could only unlock the passenger front door. So if I wanted to make sure the car was never stolen, I would have to get in the passenger side, which honestly, I didn't really care if it was stolen. The only time it messed me up was when I pulled into a parking lot and I saw somebody in a minivan that was taking up two spaces, and I was young and just kind of snotty. So I was like, well, I'll get them. I'll just pull right in here next to them really close and they won't be able to get in. And then I neglected to remember, okay, when I lock all my doors, I can only get into the passenger side door. And I put the passenger side door like 3 inches from their driver's door. So I actually had to wait for them to leave before I could go out and leave myself. So any fun, and I know I've asked this a few times, and if there isn't a clear answer, that's fine. Are there any special experiences that stick out in your mind, or any special quirks or things about different cars that you've had over the years that just sticks out to you more than others?
Well,
you know, kind of like that story that I just had with the Spirit. I've remembered that my entire life, and it's just the dumbest thing, but it's hilarious, and I adore it.
Yeah, you know, like the Mavea, you know, breaking down every 10 kilometers coming home. There's so many of those. But, you know, the shared experiences, the first time we showed a car at Pebble Beach, and we had the whole family there, and we kind of did the whole thing when our girls were young. You know, just those great memories. We did.
What was that first car that you showed at Pebble Beach, by the way?
The Paxton Phoenix. Oh,
gotcha.
Yeah. So, and we were right. It was pretty interesting. The car next to us was Porsche number one. And again, the small world about that thing. The guy who was there, who was handling Porsche number one, was Klaus Bischoff, who was the director of the museum at the time. And I was wearing a tie that I bought at the Porsche museum with Porsche number one on it. and he came over to me and he looked at the tie and he said, I designed that tie. And I kind of gave him the story of the car. And he comes back about an hour later with somebody else. An American who designs cars for Porsche, a guy named Grant Larson, probably most famous for, he designed the Boxster concept and really involved in the Carrera GT project, who got the idea to become a designer by working for Brooks Stevens when he was in high school, when the Paxton was there. And this guy's one of the big designers for Porsche, and how he got the job at Brooks Stevens. His brother was like the janitor there, and his brother's moving away to college and said, here, you need a job. So he was cutting grass and sweeping floors. He didn't know what he was going to do. And he said, you know, I'm sweeping these floors and I look in these rooms with these grown men and they're drawing cars all day. And he's thinking, you know, this isn't such a bad thing to do. So that's, The Paxton indirectly, you know, was connected to those things. So
you have owned enough cars over the years where you have brought the automotive world together just by yourself.
Yeah, it's I'm sorry. I know we're nerding out so much during this episode, but every one of these stories, I'm just like sighing during it. And I'm like, wow.
Well,
like,
this is really the core of being an automotive enthusiast. It's not going out to your garage of Ferraris and looking over them all and check out my Ferrari. It's about appreciating not just the vehicles, but the years that they have done, the interesting character that each car develops over the years, because you put 20 Honda Civics brand new on a dealership lot, they're identical. You take those 20 Honda Civics 20 years down the road, and each one is going to be special and unique in its own way. And that's worth talking about. That's worth celebrating. That's worth embracing. And to me, that's more of what auto enthusiasm means than just going out and having a cool, neat, fun, fast car. Right.
Yeah.
And Myron, I think your collection just epitomizes that, if I may say so.
Well, you know, again, the fun of it is, you know, those connections you make with people. And, you know, I've kind of spent the last 10 years of my life trying to convince people my age, enthusiasts my age, that auto enthusiasm isn't gone with younger people, right? They're just the fact that young people don't care for 57 Chevys as much as you did just doesn't mean the enthusiasm is there. And that's kind of what's led me to kind of the passion for Japanese cars, because that's kind of the taproot for a lot of people these days to get in the hobby. If the old guys in my generation want people to buy their Duesenbergs at some point, you know, you got to be accepting and welcoming of these kids that are in their Hondas and 20-year-old BMWs.
Yeah.
Well, Myron, you are echoing exactly what I say all the time, and that is that not only is that there's interest, but there's also a financial aspect to it, that I can buy a first gen RX-7 for $8,000-$10,000, maybe even less if I find a good buy. Like, I can afford that. I can't afford a Duesenberg. I can't afford a GT350R. I can't afford a muscle car. And even like some of the modern muscle cars, I can't afford them. But a lot of those Japanese cars, they've kind of lagged behind for a long period of time, especially from the 1980s, that I can actually realistically afford those vehicles, and I want to put them in my garage. Smith, you and I, we've talked about A60, A70 Supras, the RX-7, the Mitsubishi Starion, vehicles like that, that for whatever reason, they just lagged behind the American or European vehicles in their day, and we could actually afford them, and we could have a fun car that we can put in our garage and enjoy.
Well, let's not talk too much about it, because I still need to get a bigger garage so I can start buying the A70s, so I can start buying the 300ZX that I want, the Dodge Daytona Shelby Z that hasn't gone up yet. But I think, I mean, the landscape is changing, right? I remember this very, very clearly. I think it was 2001, 2002, somewhere around there, maybe a little bit later. It was Bear Jackson Scottsdale auction. In the earlier days when it was televised, you know, when they were just starting to televise it. And Brock Yates, and I miss Brock, he was commenting on the auction, what was happening. That's just when sort of the muscle car and the resto mods were really starting to come in. And there was, he was commenting that a 55 Chevy Nomad with a 350 V8 swap had just brought more money than a Ferrari. I forget which classic Ferrari it was. It may have even been a Daytona at that time. But it, I mean, that I remember that very clearly as sort of this shift where, okay, things are starting to go more from the heart, I think. And we're seeing a shift in that now, where
slowly.
I think, I think we're going to be seeing more of the Japanese cars pick up because that generation is moving to a point where they want to, what's the best way to put it? They want to buy a memory, right?
Yeah.
They remember this. They remember this from their era, so they want to buy a memory, and they also have an appreciation for that car. And Myron, I think it's a very interesting and enlightening point that you brought up about the early Korea cars. I think there's really something there to be explored, and just to experience something that not many people experienced in the United States, really. So it's like, right. What new stories are here to be told? We're going a little philosophical here, folks. So send your automotive philosophies to our email, podcast@motorone.com. Of course, you can always comment on our YouTube videos that go up at Motor One Podcast on YouTube. You can always comment on our podcast articles that go up every Friday at MotorOne.com. Bruce, do we have any time? Do we want to talk about any reader comments here from the last week?
I think we need to skip that for right now. I would really like to let Myron respond to what we were just saying, because we monopolized a few minutes of time, and yes. As someone who owns a lot of these cars, someone who has owned a lot of these cars, I'd really like his opinion on these things.
Yes.
Yeah, no, listen, I totally agree with what you're saying about the cars. They're Japanese cars right now, it's kind of a real popular thing to talk about these big numbers that these cars are going for on Bring a Trailer, right? You know, so mm-hmm. People have to remember that those are just kind of outliers. And it's great. I'm glad those cars are getting them. I'm happy for the sellers. I'm glad the buyers are getting what they want. But you mentioned like the second generation RX-7 or the A60, A70 Supras. Those are great cars that are still, you know, very accessible, mm-hmm. a lot of fun, still relatively easy to work on. Modern cars. The modern cars, they're the best, right? You know, no cars have been built faster or better than what we have today, but you really can't do anything to them. And right. What we're talking about here, cars from the 70s and 80s, you can still get in there and do your thing. The parts are still relatively available and cheap. And Japanese cars, there's still some great values of great stuff out there. And, kind of to that point, a friend and I recently finished a book on great Japanese cars, some that were really? Available in the United States, some that aren't available in the United States or are available now with the 25-year rule. The book's called A Quiet Greatness. And what started out as like a passion project to be about 300 pages turned into a 5-volume, 1,500-page, 2,500-image box set, which we're in printing right now. We hope to roll it out, the hard copies, at the Japanese Classic Car Show in Long Beach in September. So
okay, so, wow. So what's the title of that book again?
A Quiet Greatness.
A Quiet Greatness.
Okay, can you please send that to us? Because that is right up Smith and I's alley, and I suspect a lot of the people that listen to the show, because you're going to get some buyers from that for sure. So please.
It's an experiment because, you know, no one's done a great English language book on Japanese cars. And I'm not saying sure. that we're great writers. My co-author's a great writer, you know, but we've really spent a lot of time, a lot of effort. This is 4 years in the making. So we don't know that if people want to spend Porsche or Lamborghini money on a Japanese car book, but we think it'll help legitimize the hobby. We hope.
I really do.
I definitely think they're out there. We're seeing, Supras over and over and over A80s bring in six figures, right? Yeah. It's a topic that a lot of people.
RX-7s bringing yep. six figures.
Yep. Those are starting to go up.
Please share that with us, because
I think that's a lot of the people that listen to this show. They're going to enjoy that, and they like that's something that they're going to want to purchase.
Or better yet,
let me put it this way: I'm going to buy that book. So yeah. I hope people that listen to this show are going to want to buy that book.
Well, and when it comes to print, Myron, we would love to have you back on the show to talk about more cars and to hopefully help sell you some copies of your book. That sounds
absolutely
fantastic.
That was great. Yeah,
I want to read every story.
Yeah, come on with it with my co-author Mark Brinker, who's a great enthusiast and collector out of Texas. So,
okay, yeah, totally. I am 100% on board with that. Yeah,
absolutely. And yes, I was getting a little ahead of myself on the reader comments, but just want to address that. We're going to get to your reader comments next week. I know we've had some comments that have come in. We're not forgetting about you. We've just been very, very busy with guests like Myron.
But yeah, I think we're ready to wrap this one up. But Myron, thank you so much for being our guest this week, for giving us your time, for giving us like all of your knowledge. You have one of the most amazing automotive collections in the United States. And the reason I say that is that you have the most eclectic collections, that you have everything from, and I've said this before, but American, European, Japanese, like all over the world. You don't seem to care where the interesting vehicle comes from, that you just want to own them. And I love that about you. And I have been wanting to talk to you and meet you for ages. And I know I'm just geeking out right now. I know that. Like,
well, let me ask a question then, Myron. One last question.
Yeah.
Do you have a Pontiac Grand Am in your collection?
No, you know, we do one Pontiac. Actually, we have one Pontiac. It was one of the ex-IROC Firebirds.
Nothing wrong with that. I have an irrational hatred for the Pontiac Grand Am, so I have to slip that in there. I don't know where it comes from. just one of those weird things. Oh, Grand Am. Blah. Myron, I know you're very active on social. Where can people follow you at on social if you want to share your social accounts?
On Instagram, Junkman356.
Junkman356.
On Twitter, just my name, Myron Vernis.
Okay.
I've got a Facebook account, but I don't use my name. I've had it like forever. I'm Stephen Brooks as kind of a tribute to Brooks Stevens. I use a different name on Facebook. I use that because I wasn't in the car business and I didn't necessarily want a lot of people to see my car activity. So I use that and I keep it. And you kind of being a stranger on Facebook is okay because you don't get the political stuff and I really don't care what other people are eating or anything like that. So it's just car stuff. Yeah. Stephen Brooks on Facebook. You know, I do have the website that you mentioned, but I haven't even looked at it in a couple of years. Hasn't been updated in several. So I wouldn't say that's a great one yet. Our book website, aquietgreatness.com, will go live in about a couple of weeks. So kind of keep an eye for that.
Okay. Cool. I will definitely look for that.
Keep an eye on that. We'll have links to all of Myron's socials in our YouTube description and in our article that goes up on Fridays. And I'm going to make a sticky note reminder, because I'm technophobic, I'm going to make a sticky note reminder to keep an eye out for aquietgreatness.com. I'll make sure that gets updated in our YouTube YouTube video at Motor One Podcast and in our article. And Myron, thank you very much for joining us. You have a very enviable collection, and I can't wait to see where it goes from here.
Yep.
Hey, my pleasure. Great fun visiting with you guys.
Well, thank you. So good afternoon, good evening, or good night, whenever you happen to be listening to us. We appreciate it. Myron, we appreciate you being with us. And so that's the show for this evening. And so goodbye and good luck. And thank you so much. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody. Bye.